Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the classic Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Deities and Demigods supplement. In our last series of episodes, we've been looking at the Sumerian pantheon, and I asked you all to vote on which pantheon you thought you'd like to hear about next, whether that would be the Norse one or the Greek one, and it was actually pretty close, but the votes came out in favor of Norse mythology, so that's what we're going to be focusing on. One of the reasons that I'm not doing this book in order is that the different sections are of greatly varying lengths. So for example, this section on the Norse mythos is 4 times the length of the one on the Sumerian mythos. And so I'm going to try and vary it up, do, you know, a short one, a long one, a couple short ones, and so on. And in this section on the Norse mythos, in this episode, we're just going to start with a brief overview of Old Norse culture and religion, and then we're going to talk about Odin, the Allfather, and his various companions and bits of kit, and that's probably going to take up our entire first episode. So let's get started. Now, the section on Norse mythology sort of goes out of its way to portray Old Norse culture as particularly violent and warlike. It uses this description: "The Norse people created a race of gods that were as grim and savage as the people themselves," which, our mental image of early medieval Scandinavia as a particularly violent and lawless place very much comes from the commentaries of their neighbors and from the medieval literature of the Icelandic sagas. And while I'm not trying to deny that there was a lot of violence, what I'm trying to suggest is that the idea of a society where people just live by the sword and, you know, there was no civilization, you know, is not true at all. And that those other societies, you know, were also places that had what we would consider to be, you know, unjust and often violent systems as well, where wars were frequent, and feud violence was not necessarily uncommon. Anyway, it points out that the gods are divided into 2 groups, the Æsir and the Vanir, which is true. And it says that the Vanir don't deal with the lives of men, which is a real strange contention. I'm not sure where they're getting that from. I think you could hardly say of Frey that he doesn't deal with the lives of men. Kind of one of his things. So, no, I don't know where that comes from. And then it gives a brief outline of the mythology. You know, there's going to be Ragnarok, and then after Ragnarok, a new world's going to be born, right? That's all correct. And it says that the majority of these gods and goddesses don't heal people. If your god turns up, a lot of the time, one of the things that your god might do is heal you're injured. It's not really how the Norse gods work. So praying to them for healing, not really the kind of thing that you might do. It talks about human sacrifice. Now, the evidence for human sacrifice is always mixed. It was something that people wrote about in regard to Old Norse society, so it's certainly possible that it happened. Certainly animal sacrifice seems to have been a part of their religion. And then it describes temples. Now, we don't know a huge amount about the religious architecture of the Old Norse world. In fact, I would argue that the evidence seems to suggest that for the most part, there weren't really specialist religious buildings like we might think of as temples or churches, but that acts of religious worship would be carried out, you know, in somebody's home or in natural spaces. So for example, and this is not from Scandinavia, but in England, there's a place called Thundersley. And that comes from an Old English name, Thunorsleir, which means an oak grove that belongs to Thunor, which is the English name for Thor. So, you know, there might be wild spaces or, you know, particular groves or mountains or streams that were sacred to particular gods. And so temples, you know, buildings that were exclusively used for religious purpose probably did exist. There is some archaeological evidence to support that, but they would have been very rare. You know, they would have been for really kind of the wealthiest and highest status. And the description that they give, which is that they're sort of rectangular halls that basically would be like someone's house, is correct. I don't know. I mean, and it says, yeah, they're places where the gods' statues are carved in wood and are kind of kept there. And again, that's consistent with descriptions that we find in the sagas, although I'll come to that as a source in a moment. The idea of sacrificing valuable objects, that's definitely true. So, for example, in one of these buildings that's thought to be a temple, we find that in the post holes. So, you know, when the temple was being built, they dug the post holes and then put these posts into them to hold up the walls. And at the bottom of the post holes, you find these little gold sort of plaques with art on them. And so these must have been quite expensive, and they are being deposited into the foundations of the temple, basically as some kind of an offering. So now, this is not a historical podcast, but let's talk just real quickly about our sources. We know a good amount about Norse mythology, but we know less about Norse religion. To explain the distinction, I guess what I mean is that we know a lot of stories about the gods, and that's largely because these were preserved by medieval writers who were interested in preserving the traditional art form of Old Norse poetry. And the two main compilations of these poems and poetic references are called the Prose Edda, which is written by an Icelandic medieval writer and politician, Snorri Sturluson, and a compilation of poems that's called the Poetic Edda, or the Elder Edda. And we also have lots of artistic evidence, you know, from archaeological sites. And that could be things like Thor's hammer pendants, or carvings of the gods, or figurines of them, or runic inscriptions that refer to them. And there's also evidence for the worship of the gods in names. So, for example, lots and lots of people in the Old Norse speaking world have names that have Thor in them, right? Thormod, Thorbjorn, Thorfinn, Thorhall, Thorgeir, Thordis, Thorbjorg. I mean, there are just, it just goes on and on. And there are examples of names that refer to other gods as well. Thor is by far the most common, but there are other ones. So, for example, you have people with names like Freydis. And we have lots of other bits and pieces. So that tells us about the mythology, but it doesn't necessarily tell us very much about how that mythology translated into daily practice. So it's a little bit like, and this is a slightly inaccurate, possibly irreverent comparison, but imagine that you were an alien historian and you were trying to reconstruct what Christianity was like, and all you had were some stained glass windows, a bunch of records of revival songs, and the big book of Bible stories. So you would know a lot about what people believed about the life of Jesus, and you would have some idea of the principles and the characters of the Christian faith. You know, from that evidence, you would be very hard-pressed to come up with, say, the idea of going to church on Sunday, or Christmas presents. So there's a lot about the practice of early medieval Scandinavian religion that we don't know. You know, based on the best evidence that we have, it does seem like there wasn't really much in the way of an organized priesthood, and there weren't the distinctions that we would make between secular and religious power. So, for example, in Iceland, which is kind of an unusual case, priests are the same thing as chiefs, right? The word used is goði, and the chieftaincy, or priesthood, the goðorð, has both kind of political and sacrificial responsibilities. So my guess would be that you would find that the religious leader of a community might also be its sort of civic leader. It doesn't really work in Dungeons & Dragons terms, and we're not here to explore the history of Old Norse religion per se. I guess I'm just trying to say that it's more complex than it might seem. In many ways, the Sumerian religion with its temples and priests and sacred rites and things, it's a lot more like we would expect a religion to be. It then goes on to describe dwarfs and giants who play particularly important roles in Old Norse religion. And it might be that I wind up going into more detail about this in a later episode. But for now, we're going to move on and we're going to start with the first god in the Old Norse pantheon. And that is, of course, Odin. Okay, so Odin, typically just called Odin. It's Odin in Old Norse, or Woden. In English, Wotan, whatever. He's the All-Father, the King of the Gods, and we'll get into some of his other many, many names in a moment. But I wanted to start with one key point, which is that he's definitely the head of the pantheon. That's very clear. But Odin plays a very different role in the Old Norse religion and cosmology than, say, Enlil plays in the Sumerian one. And this comes down to a principle of designing fictitious religions as well, which is to say, you would think that the main god would represent the ideals and aspirations of that culture. So, for example, ancient Sumer is, you know, kind of a top-down authoritarian patriarchy, and Enlil is the ultimate patriarch. He embodies the Sumerian ideal of what rulership is. But Odin kind of doesn't. Odin engages in all kinds of behaviors that are considered absolutely unacceptable for men Old Norse society. He's accused in one of the poems of being ergi, which is a very bad thing to be, which is to say of transgressing gender norms. Interestingly, by Loki, and then Odin, because he says the same thing about Loki. So there's sort of kind of, well, we'll get to this when we get to Loki, and we'll come back to it with Odin. But Odin does all this stuff that you're not supposed to do, like sorcery. People are very in awe of Odin and his powers, but they don't regard him as honest or trustworthy. In fact, he's seen as a rather dangerous god. And he's not, by any stretch of the definition, the most popular god, right? Place names, personal names, artistic representations. The main character of this story is Thor. Thor is the beloved god. Odin is the king of the gods, but he might sort of be the god of kings, by which I mean I don't know how much ordinary people worship him. Again, given the limitations of our sources, hard to say, but I think this is a really interesting idea, that clerics of Odin might be sort of weird outcasts, respected for their power, absolutely, but also viewed with suspicion because their god is known to be shifty, treacherous, and untrustworthy. One of the things that he's accused of doing by Loki in the Lokasenna is of rigging fights so that the weaker warrior wins. And the reason that he does this is because, of course, if you die gloriously in battle, then you go to Valhalla and you join Odin's Einherjar, the army that he's going to use to fight at Ragnarok. So Odin wants the best possible people in his army, and that means sometimes setting it up so that the stronger fighter actually loses. Odin is a pretty unreliable patron. Let me give you another example of this. So Odin is a god of kings and warriors, but he's also a god of poets. And probably the most famous warrior poet is Egil Skallagrimsson, who is the protagonist of the eponymous Egil Saga. That's a medieval Icelandic saga. And it incorporates a number of poems that, you know, had existed prior to the saga being written that were attributed to Egil. And one of them is called the Sonatorek. I'm probably mispronouncing that, but it means the wreck of sons. And it's Egil's lament for the death of his son, Bodvar, who died in a shipwreck. I'm entering the poem partway through. This translation is by Christine Fell. And though men try to ease my pain, I prefer solitude. Dear son, with Odin now, son of my wife, you've joined your kin. But the cold and constant sea god has left me lonely, wrecked. I cannot hold my head up, such weariness drags it down. When fever killed my first son, Bodvar had all my best love. I watched him grow strong and straight, and knew he was free of faults. Such memories rise in my mind, and then I think of Odin. A branch was torn from my tree, but Odin bore it away to the high halls of the gods. This god has been good to me, yet I trusted him too much, and more than was good for me. For he did allow that death. Still, I sacrificed to him, not eagerly, but because he gave me my two great gifts, and they salve my heaviest hurts. I owe my art to Odin, so too my flaring temper, which makes sure foes of all frauds. So we can see here that Egil's relationship with Odin, and it's unusual for him to talk about having such a direct relationship with Odin, at least in the sagas that I'm familiar with, is kind of a painful and ambiguous one. He says that he sacrifices to him not eagerly, but because he owes him for his gifts, his ability as a poet and as a warrior. But at the same time, he is unhappy with him because of the death of his sons. He also blames the sea god, Aegir, he mentions there briefly. But yeah, Odin is a tricky character. And we're going to see a lot of this as we go through some of the myths that he's involved in. Odin is renowned for his gifts of prophecy and magic, but those aren't always necessarily seen as a good thing, since, after all, he's doomed. But listen to the way he's described in this poem. This is the Voluspa, which is the seeress's prophecy. This translation is by Andy Orchard. Alone she sat out when the aged one came, the dread one of the Aesir, as she looked in his eye. What do you ask me? Why do you try me? I know it all, Odin, where you hid your eye, in the much-famed fountain of Mimir. Mimir sips mead every morning from corpse father's pledge. Do you know yet, or what? Now that phrase, do you know yet, or what, is a little confusing. It's others, sometimes you also see it as know you yet or what, which I don't think is any better. The translation that I sort of grew up with, the Patricia Terry translation, which I realize is sort of very out of date, translates it as seek you wisdom still. But so the dread one of the Aesir, the corpse father. Okay, let's take a look at some of his other names. Okay, so here's an extract from a poem called Grimnismal, in which Odin lists all of his names. Well, many of his names. He actually has even more. I call myself Grim and Gangleri, Herjan Hjalmberi, Thek Thrid Thun On Helblindihar, San Svipal, San Getal, Hertait Hnikar, Bileg, Baleg, Bolverk, Fjolnir, Grimnir, Glapsvid, Fjolsvid, Sidhot, Sidskeg, Sigfather, Hnikud, Allfather, Atrid, Farmatir, Oski, Omi, Jafnhar, Blindi, Gonlir, Harbard, Svidr, Svidrir, Jalk, Kjallar, Vidur, Thror, Ig, Thund, Vak, Skilfing, Vafud, Hroptatir, Gaut, Veratir. Then Gangleri said, "You have given him a large number of names. Truly it would be a mark of great learning to be able to relate all the events that lie behind each of these names." That is an extract from Grimnismal that appears in the Prose Edda. Now, the Orchard translation of Grimnismal actually lists those names as English words. You see, the thing is that Old Norse names are words with meanings. So, for example, let's say your name is Thorbjorn. Okay, that's your name, Thorbjorn, but it means Thor bear. Thorbjorn, I guess I should say. And so Thor bear. So all of those names that Odin gives himself have particular meanings, and looking at those meanings can kind of give you an impression of what this guy is like. Let's take a look. I'm called Battle Mask. I'm called Wanderer, Warlord and Helm Bearer, Knowing and Third, Thund and Ud. So I guess you can't translate all of them. Hellblind and High, Truth and Fleeting and Truth Getter, Host Glad, Inciter, Feeble Eye, Blaze Eye, Bale Worker, Hider, Battle Mask and Masked One, Seducer, Much Wise, Drooping Hat, Drooping Beard, Victory Father, Egeron, All Father, Corpse Father, Attacking Rider, Cargo God, Masked they called me at Gerud's, but gelding at Asmund's Hall, nourisher when I drove my sledge, spurt at the assembly, killer in battle, wished for and boomer, just as high and shield shaker, wand wielder and graybeard among gods. Calmer and cooler, I was called at Sukmimir's and beguiled the aged giant, blah, 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 blah. He's also called the hanged god. Maybe I actually said that. But yeah, wow, that's a lot. But a lot of them are quite sinister, right? I mentioned Corpse Father, Killer, Battle Mask, Masked One, Seducer. And this ties into the point that the Deities and Demigods book makes, which is that Odin wanders the earth in mortal guise. If you encounter an old stranger on the road with a staff, some gray-bearded old man, it might be Odin. He even goes among the gods in disguise. There's a poem called the Poem of Harbard, which means something like graybeard, in which Thor meets a funny, insulting ferryman named Harbard, who is actually Odin. So Odin is also the god your characters are most likely to encounter, because it's very much part of his MO to go down among people in mortal guise. Heimdall does that too, actually, but we'll get to him when we get to him. So let's take a look at Odin's various powers and abilities. So first off, let's look at items. Now, in keeping with being a proper king of the gods, Odin is pretty conspicuously tooled up. For starters, he has his magic spear, Gungnir. As it says, it points out the strongest member of any enemy force, which is very much in keeping with Odin's aesthetic. And it has all kinds of powers and limitations on it, so that's pretty good. He's got a bow, it's pretty good. He's got a rune wand. And we heard earlier that one of his names was Wand Wielder. I'm not sure that that necessarily means that Odin has a rune wand, but it's certainly true that in Norse mythology, Odin is the expert on runes, and is sort of the patron of Saith, or sorcery, which is regarded as quite disreputable. Saith is something that is considered dishonorable, and certainly not considered appropriate for a man. So once again, we see this thing of Odin kind of bending and challenging the gender norms of the society, of which he is supposed to be the supreme patron. He's got some magic armor and a helmet, and his ring Draupnir. Now, Draupnir, and this is quite close to what Draupnir does in the mythology, every 9 nights, Draupnir creates 8 duplicates of itself, right? And nine seems to be a number that is sacred to Odin. There's a lot of every nine things in myths relating to Odin. Draupnir literally means dripper, so the idea is that it's this gold ring that drips other gold rings. And then we have a list of his various halls and lodgings, of which there are many. Okay, now we have all of Odin's various sidekicks. For starters, he has two wolves, Freki and Geri, whose names mean greedy or ravenous. And they are symbols that are commonly associated with Odin. And again, they're seen as quite sinister animals. The wolf, the raven, and the eagle appear as what they call the beasts of battle in Norse mythology. So they're, because they're scavengers, they're associated with, you know, battlefields covered with dead bodies. And they're definitely seen as animals of ill omen. And again, their presence alongside Odin shows something of the ambiguous nature of this god. So the wolf is admired in a way for its power and ferocity, but also, you know, because it's a corpse-eating sign of bad luck, and certainly Norse mythology is full of evil wolves. Then we have his two ravens, Hugin and Munin. Hugin and Munin are interesting. Odin sends them out to kind of spy on the world, and their names mean thought and memory, or mind and memory. There's these figures in Scandinavian art that wear these helmets, which have kind of horns coming out of them, and the ends are the heads of birds. They're bird-head terminals. And these are often found not just in the Viking Age, but also, I believe, earlier. And as at least one archaeologist has argued that these are not actually horns of the helmets. These are two ravens that are perched behind this figure, and that they're almost depicted as sort of emerging from him. Now, whether or not you agree with this, I do like the idea that Hugin and Munin are emanations of Odin, that he's kind of sending them out. And this would tie in with the theory, again, which not everyone shares, that Save, the form of sorcery that Odin practices, is derived from shamanic magical practices. And it would certainly connect with their names, right? That these are, in fact, parts of Odin's mind that he sends out in raven form. And there's a poem in which Odin expresses his concern. He says, "Hugin and Munin fly every day over the mighty earth. I fear for Hugin that he may not return, but I fear more for Munin." So, again, that would be consistent with the idea that, you know, they're actually part of him somehow. And finally, we have Sleipnir, Odin's eight-legged steed. This is misspelled here. It's Sleipnir. It should be P-N-I-R, not E-R, as it says here. And this is a magical horse. Loki is its mother, owing to a complicated story involving giants and a magic horse. And Sleipnir, again, appears carrying a figure presumed to be Odin in various, you know, carvings and other artworks. I'm not sure why Sleipnir has eight legs, other than to indicate that it's a magical horse. Maybe the idea is that a horse with eight legs would be twice as fast. Some people have suggested that it refers to the eight legs of, like, four people carrying a coffin, which is a very evocative image, but I don't know that there's actually a whole lot of evidence to support that theory. I mean, and Sleipnir is a pretty rugged opponent all by itself, right? 200 hit points, its hooves do 2d10 damage. So between his super kitted out magic set of equipment, his powerful magic entourage, his army of warriors starting at 4th level fighters, Odin is a pretty serious opponent, which is fine, although, I mean, it seems like only yesterday we were reading that section of the rulebook that told us that gods don't spend their time fighting mortals anyway. So what does a player character's relationship with Odin look like? Whereas we saw a worshipper of Enlil in the Sumerian section would be kind of a pillar of the community, you know what I mean? An upright exponent of society's values, you know, your real law and order type. I don't think that's the case with Odin at all. And if Odin is the god of kings, then what we have here is a society with a pretty cynical concept of what it means to be a king. A society that has, you know, a frankly ambivalent view of its rulers. Because one thing that is consistent in all the myths about Odin is that Odin has his own agenda. He is not fighting for the protection of this culture. He has a higher, weirder, mystical sense of what's going on. He can see the future, after all. He is perfectly happy to sacrifice good people, to let the bad guys win, because he needs the good guys in Valhalla. You know, and to deal with people that Norse society abhors, like sorcerers. It was very interesting that this dark and uncanny figure is the chief god of this pantheon. and that people are sort of like, there's almost an air of paranoia in how we write about Odin, right? His ravens are his spies. They could be anywhere. He could be that old man that you just talked to. No one says that about Thor. If Thor turned up in Midgard, you'd know it. But Odin is a sly, difficult, ambiguous deity, and I think it'd be fun for him to have sly, difficult, ambiguous clerics. Powerful and important people, no doubt, but there's often a tendency to play cleric characters with a certain forthright sincerity, right? I mean, paladins tend to be Dudley Do-Right, but even clerics tend to be, you know, whether they're kind of your jovial Friar Tuck character or your, you know, vampire hunter type, clerics tend to be played as people with a tremendous amount of conviction, and we equate conviction with a lack of subtlety, right? We assume that people who have sincere faith are therefore quite simple, and I don't think the cleric of Odin fits that mold very well. And I shudder to think what a paladin of Odin would be like. I mean, I guess a Valkyrie is a paladin of Odin. That'd be kind of a fun bit, I guess. I mean, again, the idea of surrounding himself with female warriors reinforces that idea of, you know, Odin being the one who bends and plays with and transgresses the gender roles of Old Norse society. So I think he goes more into our kind of like Enki category, where his clerics are seen as useful and, you know, prized for their divinatory and religious abilities, more mystical than martial, maybe. His relationship with arcane spellcasting, with save sorcery, is a little weird in terms of the way that D&D separates magic and religion, something that religions historically don't necessarily do. But, I mean, you could figure it out. But it's very interesting to think what a pantheon is like, which has as its head such a dark, gloomy, and weird figure. And that's going to be particularly true as we progress through the rest of this pantheon, and we see people that are a little bit different from this, and we look at the relationships that Norse mythology imagines for them. So next time on Patron Deities, we're going to be pushing further into the Norse myths, and we're going to talk about some, well, I don't know, it'll sort of depend how far we get. We might get as far as Frey, but we're certainly going to talk at least about Aeir, the god of the sea, Baldr, the great kind of sacrificial character of Norse mythology, and Bragi, the god of poetry. And maybe we'll get to the Fenris wolf, the one of the many apocalyptic monsters in Old Norse mythology. So please join me next time for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. And thank you once again for supporting Monster Man.